Here on Gadget Lab, we dive deep into the tech universe, tackling questions like, is giving companies access to your genetic material a good idea? And are the latest phone releases really that different than the last ones? We want to help you make informed decisions about what is worth your attention. And here's something that is undeniably worth your time, a digital subscription to Wired. Lucky for you, we are giving Gadget Lab listeners an exclusive discount, 20% off an annual subscription to Wired. Just visit wired.com and use the promo code GL20 to get 20% off a digital subscription. Use GL20 to get exclusive access to stories on the latest innovations like AI, deepfakes, and VR, as well as today's most talked about people in technology.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Mike.
Lauren.
Happy antitrust season.
Antitrust season? Wait, I thought it was like new hardware season.
Well, it's that too. But this year, instead of asking, why does Google make hardware? We're also asking, why is Google so dominant in search and advertising?
We're asking that?
Well, federal prosecutors are asking that. And we, by extension, as journalists, are too.
So is this one of those atypical episodes of Gadget Lab where we don't talk about gadgets?
Oh, no. We're going to talk about your Pixel phone. Don't you worry.
Awesome.
Goody. But then we need to address the elephant in the room. And Google is the elephant.
All right. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Gadget Lab. I'm Lauren Good. I'm a senior writer at Wired.
And I'm Michael Calori. I'm a senior editor at Wired.
And we're also joined in studio this week by Wired senior writer Paresh Dave. Paresh, it's so great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Hello.
I think this is your inaugural Gadget Lab.
It is. I'm excited to finally be here. Well, it's only been like 10 months.
We were just letting your voice get really warmed up. We were just waiting for the big news to come out of Google. So as Mike and I talked about, thankfully, we are almost at the end of tech silly season, and it has concluded with Google. Google held a press event in New York this week where it showed off new hardware like the Pixel 8 phone and a new smartwatch. It also highlighted a bunch of software updates that basically continued the trend this year of sticking generative AI in absolutely everything. All in all, felt like a pretty routine product announcement event. But this time period is anything but routine for Google. It's currently the fourth week of a historic antitrust trial. The U.S. government is investigating whether Google has used its dominance in online search to stifle competition and fill its platform with ads. And we've brought Paresh on the show because he's writing about this ongoing antitrust case for Wired. Okay, but first, let's give the people what they want. Gadgets. This is the Gadget Lab after all. So let's do a quick rundown. Mike, are you going to update your Pixel phone?
Oh, yeah, probably.
You are.
I mean, I have a 6 now and the 8 is out. So it's a 2-year upgrade path for me usually. So yeah, I'll probably upgrade.
What's new about the 8?
Well, these are phones. Phones are boring. You kind of know what to expect whenever a new phone comes out. And that is the case here. The Pixel 8 and the Pixel 8 Pro are mostly the same as last year. They have slight hardware improvements. The edges are a little bit rounder. There's a new chip inside. Google's Tensor G3 chip. It's faster and more capable than the G2 before it. The screen is a little bit better, a little bit more advanced.
Do you ever think a company would say, this is our new G3 chip, it's worse than the G2? We've gone backwards. The opposite of Moore's Law.
I mean, that does happen, right, with the budget phones. But these are not budget phones. These are flagship phones. Mm-hmm. So, of course, yes, they're always going to say it's faster and better. These are also more expensive. you get a $100 price bump on these over last year. The smaller Pixel 8 is $699 and the larger Pixel 8 Pro is $999, $100 more than the models that came out last year.
Okay, so they're getting closer to iPhone prices.
Yeah, every year.
So a big thing for Google smartphones is always the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the camera. How much better is it?
Well, there are several improvements to the camera, but they are not hardware improvements. They're software improvements. And this has been the case for a while with phones now. Like, you know, companies brag about the size of the sensor and however many lens elements they have crammed into the phone. But really, the most important thing is the software that powers the phone. So Google has always been at the forefront of computational photography prowess. And here, there are a lot of things that the Pixel can do. And these are exclusive Pixel features. They are crazy, weird AI-powered features. The most startling one is called Magic Editor. It's sort of an upgrade over the Magic Eraser that we saw earlier from Google. This is a tool that lets you remove objects, move people around in a scene, change the lighting, change the sky, erase or change shadows within a photo that you've already taken. It's crazy powerful. Mm-hmm. There's also a feature called Best Take, which will assemble a perfect photo for you of many shots. So like, let's say you're taking a picture of a group of people, like three or four people, and you shoot five photos, and there's not one photo where everybody is smiling or looking at the camera. This tool will actually like go through all of the photos that you shot and pull out the heads and the faces that are smiling and looking at the camera and assemble them all into one photograph. There's also some video stuff. When you shoot videos, you can remix the audio that's in the video to pull out the musical performance or the voice of the person who's speaking and quiet the background noises and the distractions that are happening in the background.
Yeah, they gave a demo of a baby giggling and there was a dog barking in the background and they were able to remove the dog from the background.
Yes.
Poor doggy.
Yeah. So these things aren't perfect yet, but they're still incredible to see. And they're also interesting because they show that like Google is not interested in just making your photos brighter and the colors better. It's interested in giving you the photo that you want. And it's probably stepping on a bunch of like ethical considerations and things that, you know, people like us who are journalists who are very concerned about truth might sort of squint at a little bit. But it's really like fulfilling a consumer want, right? People just want a great picture of them on vacation with a beautiful sky where everybody's smiling. And this phone can do that for you. And that's kind of wild.
Presh, what do you make of that?
I would be pretty scared, you know, not knowing what I'm seeing out there in the world if it's totally Photoshopped. I mean, it adds to the feeling that when you're scrolling on Instagram that nothing is real, right? I mean, we were so concerned a few years ago about all the filters on there. This just adds to sort of that toxicity, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote a story earlier this year for Wired titled "Where Memory Ends and Generative AI Begins." It was about not only Magic Eraser and Magic Editor, which actually, went, during the writing of it, I was very confused by which was which product, but we're learning more and more from Google each and every day. Also about Adobe Firefly, which is a plugin that is generative AI based that, you know, can dramatically change your photos in Adobe Photoshop with just like a few prompts. And the sense that I got from talking to people for the story is, well, one, that we have real issues to figure out around watermarking and provenance and whether or not that's even effective for flagging fake content. But two, we've always been able to edit photos in some way, shape, or form. Now it's just the speed with which we can do it, how quickly and accessible it is to anyone who even doesn't have a particular set of skills who can just like type some stuff in and say, dramatically change this photo.
Yeah.
And I quoted Meredith Whitaker, the president of the Signal Foundation, in that story, who had said, "Perfect your memories," which was the phrase Google used at the time. "Perfect your memories" is perhaps the most haunting phrase I've ever read. That's where we're headed.
It's so true.
Mike, what else came out of Google today? There was a new watch, right?
Yep. Pixel Watch 2, which feels mostly iterative. It's still a great watch. You know, we still like it. The heart rate sensors are a little bit better. The case is all recycled aluminum now instead of stainless steel, which I'm a little bit bummed about. I prefer. There it is.
There it is.
Wow. And I...
We interrupt this podcast for... Oh, I had Do Not Disturb on.
Same here.
Wait. Oh, there it... Well, there it goes.
Isn't it 2 minutes early? It's 11:18. Someone is a little trigger happy, so, it sounds like.
Folks, we interrupt this Gadget Lab podcast because our gadgets are blowing up. This is a test of the National Wireless Emergency Alert System. The purpose is to maintain and improve alert and warning capabilities at the federal, state, local, tribal, and territorial levels. No action is required by the public, and we require no action of you, our listener, right now, except maybe to stick with us, and we apologize for that.
I just want to note that Paresh is holding two phones, and he's struggling to turn both of them off right now.
You can't do anything with this notification. You can't make it go away.
It's not actionable.
How do you... That's,
who do we complain to about that?
This seems like an Apple problem.
I feel like we should just task it to, like...
I don't know. Don't look at me, man. I've got a Pixel over here, and I was able to dismiss it immediately.
You know, I think we need a neutral party to sort this out. Let's bother Adam Mosseri.
Maybe send him an alert.
While he's fixing Threads. Let's just fix the emergency alert system.
So where were we?
We were talking about the smartwatch.
Right, the watch.
And James Park from Fitbit was there on stage presenting it.
Yes.
James Park's still there.
Yes.
If I was that guy and I started Fitbit and I was acquired by Google, like, how many years has it been now? 4 years?
More than that,
I'd be out of there.
Yeah, maybe. Although, you know, Fitbit still exists as a company and they still have their own strong brand and people love Fitbits. And they just put out new watches last week. There's a new Charge 6 out there in the world that people are buzzing about. So, you know, it is kind of strange that Google makes many smartwatches and trackers now, and that one of them is Google Pixel branded and the others are all Fitbit branded, but they also run all Google software, Wear OS. Not all Fitbits run Wear OS, but all the most important smartwatches in the Android world are all on the same software now. So I feel like the watch is getting there, and it's still interesting to see Google like putting a lot of effort into it and making it something that's actually desirable. So I want to kick it back to you two because I know that you have both been following a lot of the Bard and Google Assistant news, which also came out this week. And I feel like we should talk about that.
Paresh AI, do you want to take the lead here?
I mean, basically, Google is integrating its generative AI, its large language model into the Google Assistant. But they aren't sort of clearly saying how it's going to be integrated. It's not going to be available on Nest smart speakers just yet. It's only available to test users. And it may be in the Assistant mobile app. It may not be. It's a little confusing how they're going to integrate it. I mean, I just want the simple things. I just want Google Assistant to know when I say turn off the TV that it turns off my Roku and I don't have to say turn off the Roku, which is kind of annoying. And here they're trying to pack it with all this more stuff. I think, Lauren, you're familiar with some of the examples that they're talking about.
Yeah, Will Knight and I, Will being our colleague at Wired, got a briefing on this ahead of the event. And to your point, Paresh, this seems like a very, very early mashup. The company did not have a name for the product, nor could Google explain how and where it will live on your phone exactly. OpenAI just announced that ChatGPT is going what's known as multimodal, which means that it's not just a text-based chat app anymore. It incorporates voice and photos. And so now that's what Google Assistant through Bard is doing. And so it felt to me like this was a feature drop race, like ChatGPT did it. So now Bard is, or Google's going to do it. But one of the examples that we got was, like, for example, when you're using something like Google Assistant now and you ask it for a result, it just gives you like a pretty simple answer. Or I use Google Lens sometimes to upload a photo and say, what is this thing? Or what is this pair of sneakers or
does
something?
Does this look infected?
And then does this... Mike, we're not supposed to talk about that. It's private. Okay, I got to try to resume my thoughts now. So you upload a photo to Google Lens and it'll, oftentimes there's a commercial element to it. Like Google Lens will show you how link to buy the sneakers that you're showing a photo of. The way that Sissy Hsiao described it, who is a VP of this product category at Google, said like, now, for example, if you are looking at a photo of a hotel on Instagram, looks cool, you can ask the assistant, what is this hotel? And is it available over my birthday weekend? And that it's able to go deeper into not just the web, but its own training set to bring back a result for you that adds more context to what that photo is. And then eventually it seems like there would be some kind of booking element to that. So then that does become another commercial product for Google, but they said they're not doing that now.
Yeah. The thing is, though, Google has been talking about completing these shopping actions through Assistant for years. And No one that I know of buys things through Assistant. No one buys things through smart speakers, really, on Google systems. So I don't feel like this gets them any closer. It still sounds a little bit wonky.
Yeah, it does. It seems like the first step is just the adding context part. And that's a delicate balance, too, because the last thing that people want is a really verbose spoken answer from a voice assistant. Like, you just want the short thing. You don't want it to go on for 2 minutes, typically. Yeah. And then it, like, the next phase seems like it would be, okay, is there a commerce angle here? But to your point, Paresh, no one's like used Alexa for that, right? That's part of the problem, I think, for Amazon.
Exactly.
Yeah, it feels like a tough nut to crack, because a lot of people are very used to clicking a buy button by themselves, making a decision for themselves about what to buy, even though like that decision is informed by all of these things that they read online, right? So they do a bunch of product research, they ask their friends, and then they make the decision to do it themselves. But asking a robot to do all that research, ask its robot brain, and then actually press the button is like a step too far for a lot of people.
I think the big overarching question is whether or not any of this makes Google search better. And Google search is what we're going to be talking about in the next segment of the show. So let's take a quick break and we'll come back with more.
This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Each episode features insight you won't find anywhere else from the center of the conversation surrounding emerging technologies like AI. Right now on the podcast, you can hear a special episode where Brad Smith lays out Microsoft's vision for a vibrant marketplace driving the new AI economy. To hear more, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
So yes, Google is still making gadgets. It's also currently part of a landmark antitrust trial. It's stacking up to be one of the most expensive antitrust cases ever. And I think more relevant to our Gadget Lab listeners, it has the potential to reshape the way competition works on the internet. So I think we've all noticed that search quality has degraded in recent years. You go to search for something pretty straightforward and your top results are all ads. Google has long promised relevance and personalization, but now the whole thing tends to feel cluttered and confusing because of Google's monetization schemes. The question at hand, though, is whether Google actually violates the Sherman Act in the way that it handles its search product. So Paresh, to start, who is bringing this suit against Google and what are they alleging?
The suit is being brought by the Department of Justice in nearly every state, district, territory in the U.S., the allegation is unlawful maintenance of monopoly. Specifically, the government is alleging that Google has a monopoly in the general online search market, makes sense, and in search ads, which also makes sense. And effectively, the allegation is that Google uses these contracts, exclusionary contracts, to become the default search provider on iPhone, on browsers. And that those contracts, you know, effectively keep out competitors because the defaults matter so much because we don't really like switching defaults. And then on the ad side, there's this allegation that Google slow walked adding support for buying Bing ads to SA360, which is this tool that advertisers use to buy search ads. And because there was just support for Google Ads, well, Google Ads dominates.
What kind of market share does Google currently have in search?
Google has about 90% of the market in the U.S. and globally. Bing's the close second, not close second, I mean, as you can tell. I mean, that's enormous.
So you mentioned that people don't like to switch their defaults. And this is sort of at the heart of this case, right? Because there are other search engines. And when you download a new browser, you get to choose which search engine is the default in your browser. But they all default to Google, and most people never change it, right?
Correct. And there was just testimony this week from the former CEO of Neva, which was a search engine competitor that cropped up over the past couple of years, speaking to this about even when they could get people to switch, you know, the default, various things sort of made people switch back. And it was just so hard to switch the majority of people over, even when they were given the option. And many browsers don't really make it easy to see those options.
How is Google's relationship with Apple a part of this?
It's a major part of it because iPhones are sort of dominant here in the US, as you have both talked about on the show a lot. And as a result, it's an important entry point into search. And one of the things that we've learned in this trial is that Microsoft was willing to lose money. It was willing to give Apple more money than it made from ads to make Bing the default on iPhones. And Apple said no.
Why did Apple say no?
Because Google can pay a lot more money.
So just to be clear, though, I think most of our listeners probably know how this works. When you're on an iPhone, you open the Safari browser to run a search and you run a quick search. That is actually powered by Google.
Correct.
Okay. What is Google likely to argue here?
Google's defense is that consumers love it, that it's just made a really good search engine, one that's way better than Bing, and that it doesn't really have an overwhelming share when you consider the broader search market. It considers Amazon a competitor. It considers Yelp a competitor. All these places where we go for verticalized search, so it's, you know, restaurants or shopping, Google says all of that is really competition. And when you bring that into account, you know, Google's market share naturally goes down. And it says it doesn't really owe anything to anyone, that there's nothing that requires it to support competitors under the law, and that it's not really harming consumers. Consumers are getting search for free, and it argues that they're generally happy with it.
Do you agree with that?
I'm not so sure. As you were saying, when you search now, so many of the things that you see are ads. And we had this experience recently where we were trying to make a last minute travel arrangement, and when we were trying to look up a visa, the first result went to this site that's like a visa arrangement company that tries to expedite your visa or something, and not paying attention, thought it was the real government website, ended up spending over $100 for what should have been a $50 purchase. Fortunately, they refunded us once we realized it wasn't the real government website. But that seems like a problem. Maybe Google shouldn't be allowing ads for on searches for government services.
Yeah. And you're a pretty tech-savvy internet consumer.
Correct. But we're always in a rush, right? You're like, you know, people are in rush. You're not looking close enough. And things like this can happen. And it can cause serious stress or serious financial distress for people.
And there's an experience on Google now, too, where Google will offer these cards of information, like it's indexing all these other websites, and you end up sometimes not even having to go deeper into that website, whether it's a Wikipedia or a Yelp or something, because of the information card that is presented to you. You sort of get what you need and you can move on. But in the generative search experience, which Google is still, I think, categorizing as experimental for those of us who have played around with it, that's pretty much what it does, right? It uses this advanced AI to serve up like a summary of the web for what you're looking for right at the top of the page. I'm wondering how generative AI is going to play into this case too.
Yep, that's what Google is experimenting with, but there's huge concerns with it. One, the information, can you trust it? We've heard all about hallucinations from these large language models. Two, it's a big concern for publishers. There's a big concern about the traffic that Google normally would send to websites when you click on a link. If Google is just giving you all these answers, how are publishers going to survive in that? And I think another thing that we've learned from this trial already, just a few weeks in, is that Google at various times has basically changed the way that the search layout looks like and the search experience works and what options you have to wring more ad money out of it. There's this phrase in one of the internal Google documents that was cited in the case that they wanted to basically shake the cushions as if they were shaking the cushions to find the spare coins in there.
So you're talking about Google sort of adjusting the layout of the page to make ads more prominent?
Essentially.
Yeah.
Hmm.
You know, I think this is really interesting time for us to be talking about this because all of these large language models are now speaking to us. And when you ask your phone a question and it delivers an answer in a voice that sounds kind of human, it changes the trust relationship, right? It makes you as a person trust the device a little bit more because it sounds like a human delivering it to you. So, you know, what happens when we start getting ads in that experience? What happens when that information is wrong? We tend to trust those things.
Even more so for vulnerable populations or younger populations, right? We know that kids love using these smart assistants, speaking smart assistants. And if we're reliant even more on them and they're providing these more wholesome answers, raises even more concerns for what kind of information our kids are being taught by these systems.
Hmm. We should try to run a search right now just to see what happens. Hold on. Google.com. What should we search for?
Does this look infected?
Does this look infected?
No, I'm just kidding. I'm okay. Just kidding.
Do you know that's a studio album by Sum 41?
No.
I didn't know that either.
You could ask.
It came out in 2002. Yeah. Okay. So, but here's the thing on the side here. There's a sidebar that says about 99% liked this album. Okay. 99% of who, I would like to know. Does This Look Infected is the second studio album by Canadian rock band Sum 41, released on November 26, 2002. That's from Wikipedia. It lists its genres, the length of the album, the producer on it, Greg Norrie, people also search for. Okay. So, like, if I was just doing a really lazy cursory search, which I am, I wouldn't really need to go any deeper, right? I wouldn't need to go to Wikipedia and click on that, or Amazon Music or Spotify and click on it. Let's see, I'm going further below. Really, there's nothing here about an actual infection, Mike. It's all Sum 41. I want to know what their SEO strategy is. So far, we're not doing actually a very good job of proving the point that the first like 7 results are ads. Let's do this. So Paresh, you were looking for how to get a visa to New Zealand. And sponsored. Then after those first, which really takes up the whole top of the digital fold here, below that, immigrationnewzealand.government.nz. I could see how it would be very easy to fall for travelservicesnewzealand.com, newzealandvisitor.online, etravelportal.com.
And really the way that the government there recommends that you get the visa is through an app. So the first result really should be a link to the app where then you can click and sort of send it to your phone to download it if you weren't already browsing on your phone.
Hmm. So what's the biggest difference between the Google antitrust case of today and the Microsoft antitrust case from 2 decades ago?
The big difference between the Microsoft case and the Google case is in the Microsoft case, the government was alleging that Microsoft was tying its Windows operating system, using its dominance there to get people to use the Internet Explorer browser from Microsoft over competitive options. There's not that same tying here. It's the fact that Google is just using these contracts to gain dominance. That's the big issue in the Google trial.
Let's say this doesn't go in Google's direction. What happens?
In the worst case for Google, it's not allowed to have these contracts anymore. It loses default status on iPhones. It loses default status on browsers like Mozilla Firefox. That could mean a lot less users for Google. It could face other types of penalties. There's been talk that, you know, it has to break off or sell off parts of its business. Maybe it can't sort of have the ads business and the search business together. That seems unlikely in this case, but there are other antitrust cases that are coming against Google. And part of the value of this case is that it's going to set the tone for some of those cases and potentially give the prosecutors in those cases a little bit of a preview of the best way to navigate those other cases.
What happens if Google wins?
If Google wins, we're stuck with it as the default. And that's unlikely to change anytime soon because they're making so much money from the search business that they can afford to continue to pay for these defaults in a way that no other company can.
Hmm. And you're going to be following this through at least the end of November, we believe the case is going to go on until?
Yes. Barring a government shutdown that knocks things awry in the trial. But I would say another thing that's important as far as like what happens if Google wins is there's also this concern that was expressed in the trial this week by Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella saying that there could be this vicious cycle with search going into AI where Google is now sort of using all this money that it makes from the search business to say that we want exclusive access to this pile of data, maybe news articles from Wired and Condé Nast. And it can pay more for those than Microsoft can because of this giant search business. And then Microsoft and its close partner OpenAI won't be able to train on Condé Nast content anymore when they're trying to train their large language models. Only Google will. And then Google's large language model ends up being better than Microsoft's. Satya Nadella sort of said in this trial that none of us have solved the problem called if in a world where most content is not crawlable, how do you build a large language model? Hmm. And is it potentially only Google that builds it?
Hmm.
So this search trial sort of could set the tone for the future of AI as well.
Right. On the one hand, I totally hear Satya Nadella's argument. On the other hand, part of me is like, oh, boo-hoo, these multi-billion dollar companies or trillion dollar companies can't afford to buy our entire data set of published content.
His argument was he just doesn't have as big of a wallet as Google
cash
does.
Pile. Yeah. All right. Press, you're going to be following this very closely for Wired, so everyone can read more about this on Wired.com. But stick around because we're going to take a break and come back with our recommendations.
Hey, everybody, it's Neil. I've got some huge news. Decoder is moving to Mondays and Thursdays. We're adding a second episode of the show. On Mondays, we'll have our classic interviews with CEOs and other troublemakers.
I think we're going to have to start having conversations about how do we pay those jobs that can't be done by AI.
And on Thursdays, we'll be explaining big topics in the news with Verge reporters, experts, and other friends of the show.
There's a new generation of people on the internet. Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal. They can just go to TikTok.
This is going to be really fun. I'm very excited about all this. So go subscribe wherever you get your podcasts now.
Paresh, as our Google of, pardon me, as our guest of honor, what is your recommendation? What is your very human, not Googled recommendation?
Well, maybe it's just because we're in a heat wave right now in the Bay Area, but I think much of the world is in heat waves, even though we're already in sort of October and in sort of the fall in the Northern Hemisphere. But I would say get some soft serve. I just learned over this past weekend about Meadowlark Dairy in Pleasanton, California, one of the top rated soft serve places, apparently. They have pumpkin spice, don't you worry. It was delicious, but I think the most important thing is that it was really cheap compared to like the crazy amounts that you have to pay for ice cream in San Francisco often. And it's sort of very, very quaint. I don't know anyone who's been to like an In-N-Out burger shop where in the drive-through line, you know, they have the people with the iPads or whatever taking orders. It's very much like that. So it's a neat experience.
What's your favorite flavor?
I got a pumpkin vanilla swirl.
You went good. For it?
Yeah. But they had chocolate as well. I didn't get to try that.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Mike, do you eat soft serve? Do you have vegan soft serve?
Yes, they do make non-dairy ice creams, okay, which I indulge in. My favorite is Mr. Dewey's in Albany, North Berkeley, California.
They have multiple locations, actually.
They do, yes. Yeah. Yes, you're delicious. Right. Thank you. There's one in like Alameda or something. Mm-hmm. Anyway, East Bay represent cashew ice cream. So good. Mm-hmm. I got to say, it is the best feeling in the world to walk into an ice cream store and be able to order whatever I want. So I really like that about it.
I just went for soft serve 2 nights ago.
That's awesome.
In Noe Valley. And I don't know in my neighborhood, but I don't know the name of the place, but I've been there a bunch of times. Yeah. You know what is it called?
Yeah, I have a little card
Yeah.
I have like a loyalty card from
it's
that place.
It's great. It's totally self-serve. So it's like, I mean, there is a human working behind the iPad. You can just go up, make your own thing, tap to pay, walk out.
Yeah, you pay
it's
by
weight.
A little
weight. Dangerous.
But that is that soft serve or Froyo then?
It's soft serve.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. There might be frozen yogurt too.
Yeah, sure. They have dairy and non-dairy
you
options.
Know what? They do. They do have a non-dairy option. Yeah. Yeah. Delicious. What's delicious. Your favorite topping? I got some Heath bar. Not that anyone asked. What's your favorite topping?
Those like mini chocolate pieces that have like the caramel inside, often very delicious. I don't know what they're called.
Mike, I'm gonna guess your favorite topping.
What is it?
Impossible burger.
Oh, how dare you?
What's your favorite topping?
No topping.
What?
Just give me the goddamn ice cream.
Naked.
What?
Yeah.
What? Life.
I feel like ice cream done well doesn't need toppings.
Fair enough. But cashew ice cream without toppings?
It's, hey, don't knock it till you try
it.
Okay. It's delicious.
All right, I'm going to go to your places in the East. Bye. Okay. All right, Paresh, thank you so much for that. Thank you for bringing us back to not only summer, but childhood in summer. I really appreciate that. Mike, what's your recommendation?
Techno thrillers.
Tell us what this is.
Okay, this is a collection of films that is this month on the Criterion Channel. So if you are a subscriber to the Criterion Channel, you can get access to this selection of movies. It goes back to the early 70s all the way up to present day, and it's all of these great movies that have to do with the internet and technology and disasters that are wrought by technology. And it's a really wonderful collection. It includes such classics as The Andromeda Strain, the original Westworld, Brainstorm, starring Christopher Walken, Videodrome, David Cronenberg movie, mm-hmm. Existenz, another David Cronenberg movie, mm-hmm. Minority Report, Dark City,
The Net.
The Net with yes. Sandy Bullock. Demon Lover, the Olivier Assayas movie. It's really great. I'm a Criterion fanboy. I'm a charter subscriber. I signed on before they even launched. And it's really nice to have movies on there there are more movies on there now that are not like, you know, foreign films or strictly underground art house movies. There are movies that were a little bit more popular in their day or have a broader appeal. And this collection pulls together a lot of those. It's a lot of fun.
I'm looking at the website right now. This is amazing. You know what's missing from here?
What's that?
Ex Machina.
Ex Machina
That's
is missing.
That's a good one, Alex Garland.
Yeah. Well, you know, the way that streaming rights work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plus, that's a little bit newer than a lot of these.
Yeah, there's a couple movies here from recently, like the Saul Williams movie, Neptune Frost, I think came out just a couple years ago, and that's on the collection.
Ooh, Sneakers is on here, 1992.
Yeah. A lot of great stuff.
This is great. Great recommendation.
Thank you.
Fitting for Gadget Lab.
And what's your recommendation?
I was going to recommend an album this week. You and I talked about it, but I'm still listening to it, wrapping my head around it. So I'm going to recommend reading poetry.
Nice.
Yeah, I've been reading more poetry at night. It's good for the adult brain, for the internet adult brain. It doesn't require the commitment of reading a big, thick book. But in many ways, good poetry is masterful writing because of its incisiveness. So I would say the three poets I've been reading a lot of lately are Louise Glück, Seamus Heaney, and Ada Limón. Ada Limón, the 24th Poet Laureate of the United States. She's amazing. I actually sort of am working my way back into her catalog because I read a poem, this amazing poem that she wrote. It was published in The New Yorker called The Endlessness. It was published in The New Yorker earlier this month. And so now I want to read more. Louise Gluck, I recently read The Wild Iris, which is a 1992 book that won the Pulitzer Prize in 93. Seamus Heaney, I'm reading a collection. It's called Opened Ground. It's select works of like 10 or 12 of his books over the past 30 years. And The Badgers is one of my favorite poems.
Are you reading these ebook or are you reading them paperback?
No, real books.
Okay. Does poetry work on ebooks?
Yeah, sure. Of course it does. But there's something about the tangible books that I still like, and also just making notes in the margins or dog-earing pages. And
wait, are you making edits in the margins? Are you like
Yeah, I've told Seamus, look, I've connected with him in the beyond.
This said, part lags.
You know, you are this preeminent poet, but I have thoughts. Yeah. Yes. No, I'm not making edits.
Have you found AI-generated knockoffs of these poets?
You know, I have not. But here's the thing. I do have faith, and perhaps this is incredibly naive of me. I have faith that the ChatGPTs of the world are not going to be able to replicate really wonderful poetry. So far, the ChatGPT, for example, it's not funny at all. Like, it doesn't do a good job with comedy. I've asked it to write skits, and they're just like, they're terrible. They're kind of pathetic. And so this is a great prompt here. Let's do it. Write a poem about, which should we write a poem about?
Write a poem about a field of flowers.
A field of flowers, and also divorce from Louise Glück. Okay, let's see. It's, oh, so interesting. There's a shield here. I'm not able to provide verbatim copyrighted text from Louise Glück's work. However, I can create original poem inspired by her style and the theme of divorce. Here's a poem for you. In a field of blossoms, colors bright, where petals dance in golden light, amidst the blooms of red and blue, a tale of love now torn in two. This is awful. This is terrible stuff.
Simple rhyme schemes.
Rhyme schemes. And actually, when you ask ChatGPT to write poetry, it often defaults to rhyme schemes.
Yeah. And like very standard meter.
Yeah. Standard meter. And like not a lot of, there's not a lot of creativity with like assonance and consonants. And like, there are no vibes.
Does it sound like her style at all?
No, it really doesn't.
One might say that there's no poetry in its response.
There isn't. And the world is filled with poetry. You just have to be listening for it. Oh. Well, we hope that this podcast was a poetic experience for all of you, or at the very least, you learned a lot about Google. Paresh, thank you so much for joining us this week on Gadget Lab.
Appreciated you having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. If you have feedback, you can find all of us on the company formerly known as Twitter. We're also on Instagram, Mastodon, Threads.
Blue Sky.
We're all the places. Just check the show notes. Our producer is the excellent Boone Ashworth, who knew that Is This Infected was a Sum 41 album. That's why he's so great, folks. Goodbye for now. We'll be back next week.
Hackers and cybercriminals have always held this kind of special fascination.
Obviously, I can't tell you too much about what I do.
It's a game. Who's the best hacker? And I was like, well, this is child's play.
I'm Dina Temple-Raston. And on the Click Here podcast, you'll meet them and the people trying to stop them.
We're not afraid of the attack. We're afraid of the creativity and the intelligence of the human being behind it.
Click Here, stories about the people making and breaking our digital world.
AI machine.
Satellite. Engine ignition.
Click Here.
And liftoff.
Click Here, every Tuesday and Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.